It's 7 minutes after 8 o'clock. You are listening to KPCW, and it is Sundance this week, but it is ski season all winter long, so we do not forget our core listener audience. And I've got Drew from the Utah Avalanche Center here, and he's going to tell us how the backcountry looks like.
Hey, morning. You know, we have an overall considerable danger for the Logan, Ogden, Salt Lake, Park City, and Pro Area Mountains. Considerable as well down on the Manti-Sky Island Plateau. High danger just off to your north and east in the western Uinta. There's still a high danger there. We've had a number of close calls in the last week alone, predominantly in the Ogden, Logan Area Mountains. But that snowpack is still pretty similar to what we have, again, in the Park City, Salt Lake Area Mountains, as well as the Provo Mountains, too. Just a weak snowpack at the base near the ground and in the mid-pack with a slab that we've seen that has developed over December and in the early part of January. Still an overall unstable situation. We just had a slide that was triggered remotely down in the Provo Area Mountains. It was a couple feet deep, about 250 feet wide, running about 800 feet. It was triggered remotely. That is at a distance, a couple hundred feet away from someone traveling in safe terrain, that is on a ridgeline there, and expect people should stay on, again, generally lower angle terrain, that is slopes less steep than about 30 degrees if they want to be in basically northwest through north through east facing terrain. On the sunny end of the dial there, the danger will rise towards moderate with daytime heating for wet avalanche activity. But again, generally unstable conditions out there in the snowpack. It's a beautiful day out there. Riding and skiing conditions are really quite good. And the backcountry should be reserved for folks with a good amount of experience and education out there. And always start your backcountry day listening to KPCW to get the avalanche report, or go to the web, utahavalanchecenter.org, for all the information.
All right, Drew, thank you so much for calling us in today.
Wonderful. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too. Bye. All right, it's 9 minutes after 8 o'clock, and we are just getting set up to start Sundance on the weekend with Rick Bruff and David Darcy.
The Avalanche Report is brought to you by the Black Diamond Retail Store, ski and climbing gear and clothing, 2092 East, 3900 South.
Support for KPCW comes from Whole Foods Market, celebrating KPCW this Thursday, January 16th. Stop by to meet Chris Cherniak and Nell Larson from This Green Earth as they interview filmmakers from this year's festival. KPCW.org.
I'm Monica Simos with the Park City High School Minor Detail Show, informing you of current events at the high school and in the community every Saturday from 7 to 8 p.m. Tune in Saturday nights or listen online at KPCW.org and like our Minor Details Facebook page.
Brought to you by UPS Stores, Elliott Work Group, and Todd Wakefield, attorney at law.
KPCW presents Behind the Gold, a look back at Olympic history, hosted by Tom Kelly. These stories are weekly on Mondays and Fridays, brought to you in part by Rosenberg, Cooley, and Metcalf Clinic at the Park City Medical Center and the Utah Olympic Park. Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher, sponsored in part by Cushman & Wakefield Commerce Commercial Real Estate and Park City Mountain Resort.
Welcome to Sundance on the Weekend. We take a break from the normal broadcasting. We got 2 hours today and 2 hours Sunday. And I'm Rick Bruff, and my co-host this morning, back with us after several years, is David Darcy. Who are you with now? You're a roving vagabond.
Well, yes, as a roving vagabond, I'm with Ann Thompson. And I saw her off at about 1:15 this morning. Nothing happened between then and now. I can tell you.
You're a married man, for one thing.
I'm a married man.
I've had a crush on you for years.
And I was and I was taking pictures of three dancers who were wearing practically nothing on Main Street last night, but they were inside, so they were warm. This was a party for the film called Finding Fela, directed by Alex Gibney, about Fela Kuti, the great Nigerian singer. The party was as good as the film, as a documentary that everyone should see. But so I'm writing for Screen International as a critic. I write for The National in Abu Dhabi, which is a newspaper that covers all the Middle East, English language newspaper. And I'm heard a lot on BBC Radio and seen on BBC Television. And there are all sorts of other affiliations. San Francisco Chronicle is a daily paper I write for all the time. I'm writing for them from here. So the list goes on. I think you heard enough about that.
Yeah, Rick. Well, just to remind people, you co-hosted the Sundance coverage with us for a lot of years with Blair Foner. And last time I think you and I did something together, we were in the little broom closet studio up in City Hall.
Right, but there are no small studios, just small broadcasters.
Yes.
And I thought we did, let's put it this way, Dennis Quaid and Tom Church didn't think we did such a bad job.
Oh, good.
As they stumbled out, yes. Hungover. Yeah. So, you know, I miss it, and it's great to be back.
Yeah, you're in the new studio, much nicer picture window view.
Yeah, and but somebody even said here that I looked great, so people are still lying in public radio.
Okay, and introduce the two guests we have to kick things off.
Right, we have Ann Thompson, who is radiant at 8 o'clock in the morning, the creator of Thompson on Hollywood, which is on IndieWire, the great film blog. And we have Bob Burney, distributor, producer, and a great source on all things independent. And I hope he'll give us some encouraging news today, because the New York Times, the newspaper of record, decreed that there are real problems in independent films. An independent film that can be solved, I guess, most initially by the making of less of them. So anyway, here they are. Bob, let's start with you. Let's just say he's so famous that his name tag was misspelled this morning. So if you're looking for a guy named Bob Barney, B-A-R-N-E-Y, you may get a response from him. Bob, you are here not to sell films, not to buy films, but you're here to look for money. Is it easier to find money here than it is to find a film that might be commercially viable at the festival?
No. I mean, I just started Picture House, which is a company that I started in 2004 and have just relaunched it. So I am, looking at all the films and also trying to find partners. But I think there are quite a few films here. I mean, I've just started, it's only been a couple days, but for example, one of the ones that the opening night film, I think, turned out to be quite a surprise, Whiplash.
Oh, tell us about it. Did you go to see it, Andrew? But I haven't seen it yet, so Bob, tell us a bit about it.
Well, I mean, it was interesting because it came from a short that was here only last year. So as Cooper said, I think it was the quickest turnaround of a short to feature. And it was stunning, stunning film. About jazz drumming, but it could be about football, sports, anything where there's a coach or a teacher that is such a perfectionist that he crosses the line to, bullying, torch. He'll do anything to make you a great artist.
And toxic bullying. I thought of Full Metal Jacket. And I thought of performance anxiety. I thought about those nightmares that you get in the middle of the night where you're standing on a stage and you don't know your lines. You know, it's about that.
It is about drumming, right? So I brought Lars Ulrich, the drummer of Metallica, to see it yesterday.
Name dropping as
guy.
Usual.
Did you,
right? I called
did
him.
You,
and
did
I
said, you cure cancer on the way?
No, but listen, Lars is such a film buff, so he's here at Sundance because I wanted to say, okay, you're filming these actors doing these amazing drums. So, I wanted Lars to tell me, okay, did they do it right? Did they really? And he said he was blown away. I mean, Miles Teller, the young kid in the movie, is a drummer, but he's sort of an amateur rock drummer. But these are complex things. So, anyway. It was. It is, as Ann said. It's the Full Metal Jacket of jazz drum movies.
Because when I saw the description, I was thinking, Isn't this Amadeus on the drums?
Yes. Yeah, it's Amadeus. It's also Black Swan. It's a horror film. Yeah. It's a horror film.
It's intense, actually. I was squirming. Squirming in my seat. It was very intense.
I started kicking the person in front of me. You know, I was drumming. You couldn't help it. And people look around and go, why are you kicking me?
She says, you're supposed to do that with the DVD, right. not in the theater. Yeah, so do you think, is there, for our audience, Bob just distributed the Metallica documentary. So he has some experience with music films. Do music films have a head start in the sense that there is a crossover audience that might reach art house, independent crowd, and a music audience, or a musical investors who come in on the front end?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think there's been a lot of, mainly music documentaries, and there seems to be quite a few here as well. You mentioned Fela, but I think it's sort of a built-in audience that you can reach with the audience or whoever the film's about. In Metallica's case, you know, reaching their audience on social media, and they're connected. So, think about 20 Feet from Stardom last year. So it's a good genre, and I think most of those films do get picked up and get distributed in some form.
Back to your original question. I do think a lot of people are talking about this whole question of what the viability of distributing this huge number of independent films. And Manolo Dargis of the New York Times was distraught on some level that the paper of record had to review something like 990 movies last year. And a lot of it has to do with triggering these deals and VOD and being able to show in other platforms. So you need the theatrical release in order to justify that, and the New York Times review specifically. Yeah. And around the country, people don't see movies as many theatrically, but the barrier of entry has become so low that it's like music. You have little tiny movies. And Bob, I am curious to know what you think where this sort of distribution economic model has to go. I mean, it isn't in the right place right now, that's for sure.
Well, it's for the micro distributors and all the different ways to put films out, it's probably an interesting time. People are buying films that, that may or may not be a distributor or have any way to put it out. Then they try to find a way to put it out. But the prices are pretty tough. So if you're a producer or a filmmaker wanting to sell your films and you're hearing about all these outlets, one thing you also hear is there's no money. You know, to buy your film, but we'll take it. So there's a lot of places to go, but economically, you know, to actually be able to make the movies with any revenue, it's scary. There's a lot of films in New York. It's interesting that the Times policy of reviewing every film is probably the only place, right? How many?
No,
there's no other outlets. So
it may change.
Yeah, it may have to, although, you know, or Manolo and Tony, they're going to have to just go 24/7, you know, reviewing. I mean, it is tough. I hope it doesn't change, because having that coverage in the Times has always been kind of the way to sort of validate the film, and filmmakers want that, and they'll do anything to sort of set that up, which probably forces a lot of films into small theatricals that shouldn't, or it doesn't matter.
That's right.
Or an alternative might be, and this seems practical, although I'm not terribly encouraging, is that you get certain films that get placement in the hard copy and online, and the second tier is that the other films are just reviewed online. Because if there's one thing that has that enjoys even less esteem than independent film, it's a film reviewer, and these guys come surprisingly inexpensive on the marketplace. So, you know, they're there and they're available in the films, and you know,
they don't necessarily have that credibility or that authority that somehow the New York Times possesses.
Yep, that's true. That, let's just say, that is another thing that is coming into question also. The credibility of the reviewer and the value of the review in the marketplace for a lot of films. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, well just I guess what is the Times definition of define every film? Because even leaving that independence, I take it the directive is not to, you know, the horror, sci-fi, comedy, romantic, melodrama stuff that would just go straight to tape.
If it has a full-bodied one-week theatrical run in New York, and that's the question, should they change the barrier of entry so that it's more rigorous?
And you have – I mean, what you have is this odd mini-economy of theaters which are four-walled, meaning that the distributor pays the cost of releasing the film just to get that review in the New York Times to give whatever credibility there might be to the film. So yeah, it's turned into its own little kind of economy with its own logic.
And how many credits are on staff at the Times?
They have two full time, and they have three, I think.
And then they use
a lot of freelancers.
Yeah,
well, the cheapskates could maybe hire Roving Vagabond or something.
I've done it.
He has his highs and his lows in terms of work that's available. And I have to say, I'm busier than a lot of journalists, which is kind of discouraging. But look, when we're looking at numbers, I've been talking about this I did a story last year in The Guardian around this time. Are independent films just expensive blogs? First of all, we do have too many films made. And Bob, you were saying this 10 years ago.
It's just gotten worse.
This is a kind of a dog bites man story, frankly, everybody's been talking about it.
Yeah, no, it's more than ever. I don't know if it's, again, it's not necessarily bad in that how do you, who's going to define, what should be made and what shouldn't. And these opportunities somehow are making more films be funded and purchased, and so it has an effect, and you never know when something's going to come out of one of these. So,
Beasts of the Southern Wild is one example of something that came out of nowhere.
Well, yeah. I'd argue that it didn't come out of nowhere.
At the Institute,
it had been a play before that. So there was some history to the film Beasts of the Southern Wild, which was one of the great successes critically out of Sundance. Was it 2 years ago? Right, 2 years ago.
2012.
Looking at numbers, having been through making a documentary film and having difficulty distributing it, looking at numbers of films that were really critically acclaimed, you have things like Leviathan, a doc from last year. Every critic loved this film. It was on 10 best lists. People said it was an extraordinary work of filmmaking. You had Kirby Dick's film, The Invisible War. Neither of those films at the box office, total box office in the United States, broke $70,000.
But Invisible War went on, which was 2012, went on to be, nominated for things. I mean, it had
a significant policy
on television too.
Effect also. But the numbers, I hate to use this cliche, but the numbers, even for critically respected films, often do not add up. Any thoughts?
The documentaries and some of the smaller art films, there's other goals oftentimes. I mean, particularly with documentaries, like to actually, affect people, change policy, So it is tough. But I do think they probably come out from the ancillaries or, television.
Just for our audience, tell people what ancillaries are.
Well, just through digital releases, iTunes or Amazon or smaller webcasts. I mean, there's ways for these to get out there. Whether the numbers work, is questionable. But some of the films are getting out, and I think that's probably the point. There are more ways to do it.
Okay, we've noticed that, and we've been told that video on demand for many films has been the way to reach the marketplace and actually monetize the project. Talk about that and talk about how difficult it might be to validate that assertion, i.e. that here are the numbers, this is how much money it's made, because these are not public numbers.
That's
right?
The problem.
Yeah, they're not public, but enough is going on that you have the sense that it's working to some degree. So companies like IFC Films, Radius, Magnolia have either gone to policies where they open in one theater or a few theaters at the same time they're on video on demand, or they're on video demand 1 month before they appear in theaters, which is called Ultra.
And they charge a premium.
And you pay more. So, it's become the way, like 5 or 8 years ago, you would say, look, your film has gone direct to DVD, or direct to video,
and that was the mark of shame.
It was because, and yet at the time, there were several films that went straight to video, in quotes, that actually made a lot of money and worked. Like, and now it's become a way, when the bar for doing a theatrical film has become so high and so tough and so expensive, that the video on demand is a way, is definitely a viable way to do it. It's still, you still don't have the real numbers, and you can't say that it's equal to, say, a theatrical, but it's starting to, in some cases, work. But you have to have names to, or you have to have a pure genre film to make that really work. In other words, on the video on demand, if the audience, if you don't know about the film, how are you going to find it? When you go to your interface, everything's kind of alphabetical.
Right.
So if something has stars, you know, you might find it, or if it's a specific genre.
People are making their movies titled AAAA so that they can be – I'm not kidding.
Is that really true?
No, it's like the Yellow Pages. AAA action adventure movie.
Triple X, yeah.
No, you could have action adventure adult, which would give you, the trifecta. Yeah.
But Margin Call was a movie that did well, and they boasted about it afterwards, and Arbitrage. You know, these are VOD hits, if you like.
Well, The Killer Inside Me, which, I gave it a – I said in a review for Screen, I don't know how many years ago it was, this 4 or 5 years ago, Michael Winterbottom's adaptation of the James M. Cain novel, second one to have been made, by the way.
No.
I think it's Thompson.
Bill Thompson. Jim Thompson. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. That's right.
I know my own last name.
That's right. I apologize. It's early in the morning. I'm told it was sold to IFC for $1 million. And they did $2 million on VOD. Have you seen those numbers, Bob?
I haven't seen the numbers, but I think that's a great example of it had a cast, and it was no matter how, even though it was Michael Winterbottom, you would say think of genre film, but it was. Or from a Sundance film, either last year or the year before, Bachelorette, that looked like kind of a smaller version of a big studio version with big names.
That's right.
Those movies found an audience because of the cast that were immediately recognizable, or a certain genre that you thought you knew what that movie was.
Right.
Well, but Bob and Ann both. Since we seem to have passed now officially from one era to the other with the official death last month of Blockbuster, so we've gone from the era when these untheatrical movies maybe attracted attention at the video store. Maybe they didn't play in my theater in Salt Lake, but they'd put a banner about it up at Blockbuster or something. And now we've left that age and gone to, as you said, the video on demand. Is it worse now for those pictures to get attention, or was it just about the same situation when they were in the stores?
I think it's actually better now. I think the digital, the VOD, and all the outlets, it's actually better because more people, theoretically might hear about them or see them. So I actually think it's probably better.
I didn't hear that Blockbuster collapsed. So it shows you what I'm watching.
Well, I do think that there's a marketing gap, and there are movies that just don't have. Festivals become very important. Sundance is a place that helps to establish a title or give it a buzz or give it some kind of profile. Critics, there are online critics who do that, who established a following and a real audience. Someone like Drew McQueenie of HitFix comes to mind, or The Playlist, which is on IndieWire, my sister blog. But it's harder, and I've always remembered this one guy saying that nothing replaces 5 weeks of word of mouth in a theater. And I don't think anything has replaced that.
No, I don't think you can, because word of mouth is the ultimate way for people to hear about films. And it is very tough. That's the one thing that theatrical gives you a chance for people. It buys you some breathing room for people to talk about the film and then get to see it. But still, I feel like it's probably... there's probably a shot to get your film out there in some way now, and with all these outlets.
Yeah. Well, for instance, for a film like Quiplash, what's the prospects of of getting that out into a broad number of theaters?
I would say it's very good. I think that's a strong film that will definitely get sold, if not I'm pretty sure it probably got sold last night.
Who do you think bought it?
I would say any of the, you know, the players like Roadside or A24 or even a bigger company might buy a film like that.
It
will get great. It has gotten really good reviews so far, and it's a film that could be played in the newer distribution model or a traditional theatrical.
And it'll play college towns. You know, it'll get a young audience. And Miles Teller is a truly exciting actor. He was great in Spectacular Now, and he really shows what he can do here. I'm going to talk to him later. I'm looking forward to doing that.
Is there a little, again, having not a name maybe, but a face with J.K. Simmons there? Is the guy from the farmer, from the insurance commercials. And that,
or
that
Oz.
Was crazy.
J.K. Simmons.
Or Juno.
He's one of my favorite character actors. And now in this film, he has a lead. And he's outstanding and very scary. He kind of – these close-ups on his face kind of look like in Disney's Fantasia. Remember the kind of mountain devil? You know, he is intimidating.
Okay,
great.
Well, speaking of that kind of face, has either of you seen Frank with Michael Fassbender?
Yes, I saw Frank. Although I didn't actually see – don't want to reveal too much. You don't really see Michael Fassbender's face.
Seems like a
movie.
Waste to me.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of women are complaining.
We're not happy.
Yeah, exactly. So you have an asset, if we can call it that, with a face, but you see a paper mache head on, or whatever it's made of. You see a big head that's covering him the entire film. Is that right?
Yes. He is a very shy, kind of disturbed, you know, man that is trying to make art and be in a band, but he can't face public, so he's able to, survive with this fake head, but it's 24 hours, so even his closest associates have never seen him.
What did you think of the movie, Bob?
I mean, it was very ambitious and experimental. It's kind of a polarizing. You know, film. People are going to love it or hate it.
There were some raves on Twitter.
Yeah,
right. So
it's a very cool film. You know,
so presumably the double feature is the dodo bird of the film industry, so that we won't see a double feature of Whiplash and Frank, two indie music films.
Well, they're actually related in that way. You know, in other words, it's funny because seeing them back to back, that they're both music films and they're both about trying to make it and be a perfection, because it's the same thing. And it's just – it was interesting. And there's a lot of interesting music in Frank. It's another music film. So there's definitely a theme going on.
Why is that? I mean, as somebody who just had a music film in cinemas, why is this happening? Why the music films? Is it a drive? Are there enough of them to identify a discernible – trend here?
I don't know. I think music is so critical to all films and it drives them. So I think it just makes sense. But I think about artistic or creation or finding a voice, you know, is a theme that, you know, and just finding a way to go in your life that music and art, you know, are subject to these films.
Talk about other things that you've seen we haven't done.
I saw Rory Kennedy's documentary, Last Days in Vietnam, which was excellent. You may remember all those photographs of people, you know, trying to climb onto helicopters. Yeah. And it's really about the last days in Saigon when there was no really carefully planned evacuation, and there was this mad rush to get people out, and the heroes in the U.S. military who actually had to go behind the backs, under the radar of the ambassador who was blocking all of this. I didn't know any of this, and there's some dramatic footage, archival footage, and they brought the real guys to Sundance, and they were there last night, and they got a standing ovation. It was wonderful.
Let me say something quickly about that. There is an eerie feeling with music from the time, almost like elevator music, that complements this refusal to recognize what the United States had already said, that they weren't they had said they were going to defend Vietnam. They'd made a decision not to, and right before the panic, and it's really a cinematic evocation of what was inside at the time.
Eerie parallels.
Okay. We have to thank producer Bob Burney and film critic Ann Thompson. And just real quick, Ann, have you got a book out?
Oh, thank you. That's so kind. The $11 billion year from Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at the Hollywood system. I know that's a mouthful. That comes out in March.
Oh, okay. It's not at Donnelly's bookstore yet.
Not yet.
Okay. Wait, if you pay a premium, can you get it on VOD?
You can get one little plug here. You can get Metallica Through the Never on VOD next week. Next week.
All right.
Thank
you,
for
Bob and Ann.
Thank you.
Each week, KPCW produces 5 public affairs programs. Join us at 9 a.m. weekdays for Mountain Money, This Green Earth, The Mountain Life, Cool Science Radio, and Fun Friday, sponsored in part by Prudential Utah Real Estate and San Francisco Design.
The Glitter Tint at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glitter Tint restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glitter Tint serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
In the morning, and we're here again with film critic David Darcy and two of the people behind the film Green Prince. We have the director Nadav Sherman. Hello, Nadav.
Good morning.
And one of the central characters in the documentary, Ganin Ben Israq, and it's interesting sometimes that. The central people in the documentaries, we call them characters. Like, no, you are a real person. It's a documentary, so you're actually real.
Well, yeah.
I think that bringing that up, let's look at that more positively. When we talk about people in this documentary as characters, I think that what we are assuming is the kind of narrative momentum to this film that makes you. It reminds you that you're watching a great story, and these characters are what are driving it ahead. And it's quite a story. Just so for our audience who hasn't seen this film, Nadav, who was the Green Prince? Who is the Green Prince?
The Green Prince is actually the code name for Mossab Hassan Youssef, who was still is the son of Sheikh Hassan Youssef, one of the most prominent figure in Hamas in the West Bank. And he was drafted or turned, depends how you look at it, to work for the Israeli intelligence, the Shin Bet. And he was operating for 10 years, passing on information, carrying out secret missions to fight terrorism. And Gonen, who's here with us today, was his handler. And the story of the film, The Green Prince, is the story of their very special relationship.
Yeah, it was described last night at the screening of The Best of Enemies Became the Best of Friends. I mean, Ganin, is it an accurate description? And sort of what can you tell us what that means?
You know, we came from a totally different background. My father was a 3-star general in the Israeli army. He was fighting the Egyptians during the 73 war. He was fighting Syria and Lebanon during the First Lebanon War. And in 1985, he was actually in charge of the West Bank. At the time that Hassan Youssef, Sheikh Hassan Youssef, Mousab's father, was building the power of Hamas in the West Bank. So you see, I grew up with the general, and he grew up with Sheikh that actually built Hamas, and each one of us, you know, took his ideology and studied his ideology at home. I became a Shin Bet handler. He started to be some kind of a Hamas member in the Kutle. Kutle is the student movement of Hamas in high school. And during that time, he wanted to do some kind of a terror attack. He was a very angry person. He tried to buy some weapons and attack Israelis. At the same time, I joined the Shin Bet, and my position was to capture people like him and stop terror attacks in the region. And this is, you know, this is the setup of our relationship. He was captured, he was arrested because he bought some weapons and they intended to make a terror attack. I was a handler. My mission was to recruit people like him. It was crucial to have information sources, what we call Humint. This is the human information that you gather through people that have key positions in the terror organizations. And this is how our relation began.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been hearing so much about the NSA and about computer-gathered intelligence. What's the value of Humint, and why is it so important, particularly in a smaller context where people are really, have they declared their intentions to kill each other, to have this kind of intelligence? What's the value of that?
Today it seems, and I remember as an intelligence officer, we had all the time some kind of competition between the SIGINT, all the electric information that you gather, either phone calls or whatever, emails, and the Humint. And it seems like the last decade, or the last 10 years, sorry, SIGINT is very important because you have networks, and Humint is less important. But actually, without Humint, you cannot really understand the intentions, the motives. And you can have all kind of information. If you don't have someone inside to tell you what it means, you understand nothing. I remember one time we had an operation in Armala. During this operation, we got a secret, something that looked like a secret message, and a very high-profile terrorist sent a message to another high-profile terrorist telling him, bring 7-Up. And all the agency, the Shin Bet, was crazy. People said, okay, 7-Up, it means 7 terror attacks that are going to be carried and so on. And, you know, I looked at it and said, you know, it doesn't look good. Let's try to understand. And I started to ask people around. You know, you ask your agent, your sources, what's going on. And one of them said, you know, there is this guy, this terrorist, he goes to a certain place and he is crazy about 7-Up. And the 7-Up was 7-Up. It wasn't terror attacks.
Yeah, right. So. Right. Well, as Sigmund Freud said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Right. Right.
Now, Nadav, how did you find this story? And how did you – did it take any – I mean, first of all, there's a third person in this, the Green Prince himself, who was supposed to be here today. Why isn't he here? Who is he? And he's a little troubled by this, or
I don't know. Any security concerns, or was he just hard party in last night or something?
No security concerns. No, I think it's just been very overwhelming. Listen, we premiered the first day of the festival, which seems like a month ago, but it was just, 36 hours ago. So we all flew in, and we had an incredible premiere. Gonen and Mossab got standing ovations. 8 hours later in the morning, we had our second screening. Again, they got standing ovations. They did Q&As. We've been doing interviews all the time. And we had a third screening last night. And I believe it's a lot. It's a lot to take. And I think also to see, it's a very personal story. I mean, you've seen the film. You see how personal it gets and how emotional it gets. And I think that just, just the overwhelming attention that he's been getting, since he arrived, it's a bit too much, and I think he needed a bit of a rest.
Certainly. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Now, to your question, David. So, Mossab wrote a book, and when I'd read this book, first of all, for me, it was sort of an eye-opener about Hamas, because I was living in Israel at the time, and Hamas had won the election. They were our neighbors. All I knew about Hamas is that they were, yes, a social political movement, but they were also a terrorist organization. But I realized we didn't know much about Hamas, and I thought it was crazy. These are my neighbors, it's like Mexico for Americans, and we don't know the first thing about them. And Mossab's book, gave an inside perspective, and I thought that was fascinating. And then, to one of our associates, I met Gonen. And when I understood the nature of the relationship between Gonen and Mossab, as you said, the best of enemies who become best of friends, I remember that meeting really well, I was instantly filled with hope. And that's not something that you get in your everyday life, And especially living in that region. People are trying to make peace all the time. They're talking. But you know what? It's not happening. They don't trust the leaders, the Palestinian leaders and Israeli leaders. They don't trust one another. Without trust, there is no peace. There is no hope. And when I understood the relationship between Gonen and Mossab and how much hope it gave me, and I see this here at Sundance, every single screening, after screening, when Mossab and Gonen come on stage, first of all, everybody gets up and applauds, people have tears in their eyes, and they talk about the great hope that this brings in a situation which seems hopeless, how these two individuals can connect. So then, I met Gonen, and I was instantly, just understanding the nature of the relationship made me want to do this. I felt that I had to carry this message and to show, look, things are possible if people sort of trust one another. And then I flew to America to meet Mossab. We met in New York, and I remember that day really well because I flew in and I was waiting for him in a hotel lobby. And as I was waiting for him to arrive, they had just announced that Osama bin Laden was assassinated. And first of all, everybody was glued to the screens. This was big news. And within 3 minutes of this announcement, Mossab walks into the lobby. And he was like really excited. He's like, did you hear the news? And I was like, yes. He's like, we got to go to ground zero. Within 5 minutes of meeting the son of Hamas leader, I was with him in a taxi going to ground zero, where America was celebrating as if they had won the World Cup in football or something. Everybody was screaming, America, America. And Mossab was there, and he was really trying to participate in this in this exhilaration. And I found that fascinating because 2 years before, he was, a Palestinian, yes, an undercover agent, but he was deeply rooted in Palestine. And because he had gotten asylum in America, he was trying to find a new community for himself and really trying to fit in and now celebrating. And this is a man who 10 years earlier would have, cheered for the missiles flying onto Israel, for example, So the transformation was so great. And I, just meeting Gonen and Mossab, made me want to do this.
Yeah. Well, as when he was a loyalist with Hamas, were they staunch allies of Al-Qaeda and bin Laden?
I don't know. Well, Hamas is an offshoot of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. I don't know what their relationship is with Al-Qaeda at the time. But they're opposite sides of the fence of where we stood, or standing still.
Yeah. During the filmmaking, how often were the three of you together in making the film?
Well, we were together, I would say, for half of the shooting. You've seen the film, so it's composed of very stylized interviews with Mossab and Gonen, but we were there at the same time. And we actually had one afternoon, which was actually quite interesting, where Gunen was interviewing Mossab. They took my chair and Mossab was interviewing Gunen.
Gunen, you know, speaking of relations between, you know, handlers and prisoners, what about the relationship between documentary subject and director? I mean, did you have to establish a certain amount of trust and like, what's this guy, you know, want to do?
Is it
here?
Like handling?
Yeah.
Well, actually,
did you feel handled?
Nadav, this is a very good question, because actually I found myself in the opposite place. Nadav was handling me. It's almost exactly like a handler and a source. This time I was the source and Nadav was the handler. But I'll tell you, it is something that without full trust, I couldn't do it. And I remember the first meeting with Nadav. We were sitting in Tel Aviv. He started to ask me some questions. I felt that his questions came from a very understanding point of view. It wasn't just, you know, you can take this story to many places. You can think about the action, to ask about what you did, what kind of operations. This is something very sexy, you know. We can talk about what we did. Nadav understood something very deep in the story. And from that point on, I just knew that Nadav is maybe the only one that can really take the story, because I wouldn't do it, you know, I wouldn't talk about it. It's not something, you know, I didn't have any urge to go and tell the story to anybody, because this is a very, for me, it's a very personal story, and there are still open ends in the story. So it was very hard to talk about it.
Now, when you're in Shin Bet, which is Israeli intelligence, are you allowed this the encounter with Nadav took place after you had left Shin Bet, is that right?
Yes.
What are the rules? We have all sorts of rules for people in intelligence about talking to other people about what they do.
Well, here in America, after they leave, they usually publish everything online, right?
this is very problematic, because there's another film here called Last Days of Vietnam, which was detailed in extreme precision by Frank Snepp, who was in the CIA and who was, as you'll see in the film, trying to plan more or less organized withdrawal, which of course fell apart. You'll see this if you have time from your interviews to do anything here. And the book came out, but he was sued by the government, and this is still a big discussion. But in Shin Bet, are you allowed to say anything while you're still an employee? And how does that, after you leave, are there still restrictions on what you can say?
Of course, that while I'm in duty, on duty, I'm not allowed to talk with anybody except the agency. And this is a very, very strict rule. You understand why. It's reasonable. Let's say that you can say a relationship of a Shin Bet agent or handler with a journalist is worse than his relationship with the Russian agent, okay?
That's treason.
It's treason to have any kind of relationship with the journalist. Now, when I leave the agency, I'm still under a very strict rule that says, basically, there is Section 19 of the Shin Bet law that says that I'm not allowed to talk about what I did during the time I served in the Shin Bet. Today, coming out, talking on this documentary about my relationship with Mossab, someone can say that I just breached this law by not getting any permission from the Shin Bet. But first of all, we're talking about our relationship. Yes, you know, the setting is what happened during the time we served the Shin Bet, but we are talking about a personal relationship. And I think that after the gatekeepers, when I saw that there is the gatekeepers...
Tell people what the gatekeepers was. I think our audience might not know.
The gatekeepers is a documentary.
It's a very good documentary.
It was here a year ago.
Yeah.
By Dror More, this is the director. He interviewed five of former heads of Shin Bet. They are talking about what happened during 30 years of Shin Bet work in the West Bank. In this documentary, those people are talking about decisions that they took as former Shin Bet leaders.
Yeah, they're talking about also the process of decision-making.
And the process of decision-making.
Yeah, and the film was nominated for Academy Awards last year. The big difference, you got to say, between the gatekeepers and the Green Prince, forgive me for cutting in, is that the gatekeepers, you know, these are very powerful people who were running the Shin Bet, this intelligence agency, but they were sitting behind their desk. And they were basically, in the film you see, you know, they're going back and saying, we should have done this, we should have done that, and they're full of regret. Whereas Gonen and Mossad were two people in the field who actually risked their lives and took decisions for what they believed in. They risked their careers. They lost everything. You know, Gonen lost his job. He was thrown out because of the decisions he made. Mossad lost all his family. He lost his identity in a way. So they had a very strong moral compass, which they acted on. And the gatekeepers, these people didn't act on them. They also have a strong moral compass. They didn't act on it. They stayed within the system. So this, for me also, it is very important to point out, the Green Prince is not only about Palestinians and Israelis. It's about two people who understand or will come to the conclusion that the system they operate in is wrong, and they actually take the bravest decision to step out of it. Now, you could be working in a bank or a radio station or a supermarket and go to a weekly meeting, and the boss says something which you don't agree with, and you could either shut up and keep your job, or you can speak up and risk losing your job. These are two people who speak up.
We've seen, but what is happening is that a number of films are calling in Israeli intelligence and the Israeli mission of this adversarial relationship with Palestinians into question. We've had Room 514, The Gatekeepers, Omar. Why are these films happening now?
Well, listen, conflict breeds drama. Drama breeds films. You know, one of the reasons you have unbelievable films coming out of Israel or the whole region is the conflict. The conflict creates a lot of human drama.
But you live in Germany, right? Why not live in Israel? Why are you?
Well, I share my time between Israel and Germany, but it's circumstantial. I'm just, you know, doing projects in Germany at the moment.
Yeah. And films breed the screening schedule. So for Nadav and Janin, I've got to tell the audience that the next two screenings for your film in this area, Wednesday at the Redstone Cinema in the afternoon, and next Friday, 3 p.m. at the Temple Theater. So those are your next two chances to see The Green Prince. And Janin and Nadav, thank you very much.
Taking Shin Bet to a synagogue in Park City. The temple is a synagogue that's been repurposed during Sundance, as everything in this town is, for films. So good luck.
Thank you very much. God bless. God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming to
Shin Bet. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Alpine Apothecary, individually tailored prescriptions, customized skincare, supplements. Visit Historic Park City and experience the main attraction, historicparkcityutah.com. Park City Meat and Provisions Butcher Shop, now open in Prospector. Peterson Calder Real Estate, Prudential, Utah, selling Park City since 1989. Experienceparkcity.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. Additional funding for KPCW has been provided by Right at Home, 1745 Bonanza Drive, furniture and home accessories consignment. Gallery Mar, fresh contemporary art on Main Street, gallerymar.com. Park City Gynecology, Park City Metasthetics, Women's Healthcare, Age Management, 435-214-5335. Rally Interactive, makes apps, websites, and other digital products. Rallyinteractive.com, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
All right, we've got Sundance on the Weekend coming to you from 91.9 FM KPCW Park City in the Heber Valley, 88.1 FM in Camas and Coville, and online worldwide at kpcw.org. 28 degrees outside the Sweet Alley Studios. We are going to go to NPR News in just a moment, followed by another hour of Sundance on the Weekend with Rick Bruff and David Darcy. Whole Foods Market proudly supports KPCW as the official provider of pastries, fresh squeezed juice, and other natural breakfast items for KPCW's Green Room during the Sundance Film Festival. Whole Foods is located in Kimball Junction off Highway 224, open 7 days a week. Whole Foods, from the gourmet to the everyday, organic groceries, prepared meals, party trays, sushi, and more.